He who lives by the crystal ball soon learns to eat ground glass. Mad Money Machine, Show 59, Third Week of April. Here's a question for you. Should Warren Buffett, now that he's 77 years old, invest in a year 2010 Target retirement fund? Why or why not? Thank you so much for joining me. This is Paul Douglas Boyer, and yes, it's the Mad Money Machine. I'm going to talk a little bit about Target retirement funds, and we'll talk about doing it yourself and a whole lot more coming up on the Mad Money Machine. So should Warren Buffett invest in a Target retirement fund? You know, Vanguard has the whole range of Target retirement funds. For example, the Vanguard Target Retirement 2005 fund, or the Vanguard Target Retirement 2010, all the way up to 2050 fund. For example, if you are between 29 and 33, then you should have the Vanguard Target Retirement 2040 fund. What is a target retirement fund? It is a multi-fund portfolio that automatically becomes more conservative as you approach and enter retirement. So should Warren Buffett invest in a target retirement fund? I think the answer to that is no. And why not? Because you've got to look at the five dimensions of a person's risk capacity. And I'm getting this straight from the source, Index Funds, a 12-step program for active investors. Dimension one is your time, horizon, and liquidity needs. Dimension two is your attitude toward risk. Dimension three, your net worth. And dimension four is your income and savings rate. And dimension five, investment knowledge. Well, we can see that Warren Buffett scores high in dimension three, net worth, and scores high in dimension five, investment knowledge. Therefore, it doesn't appear to me that he would need a target retirement fund. Well, who does? Do you need a target retirement fund? A target retirement fund has got to be one of the ultimate lazy portfolios, right? I mean, it's a single fund that you put your money in and you don't worry about it. What's the problem with it? The problem with it is I think it might be just a bit too conservative for a lot of people. And I think the other problem is I don't think the returns on it are as much as you could otherwise get. And if you're a young person, you know, instead of investing in the year 2050 target retirement fund, I think a slice and dice portfolio for you could help you get to your target retirement a lot earlier. The ultimate lazy portfolio is letting someone from Index Funds Advisors manage your portfolio for you. They can keep track of your risk capacity throughout your life. They can match that to a proper risk exposure, and you can invest and relax. So my feed at Apple iTunes appears to be broken, and I don't think it is my fault, although I'm going to look one more time through the details of my actual feed file to see if there's any kind of strangeness going on there that makes it incompatible with Apple iTunes. And if I can't find anything, what am I to do? And what I mean by the feed being broken is some people have written to me in an email saying, I use Apple iTunes on a Macintosh computer and your shows are not being updated in the listing of podcasts. Well, one of the remedies there is to unsubscribe from the show and then subscribe to the show again, and it will pull down the feed directly. But that's not a viable solution for a lot of people for the long term. So what is the solution? I guess contacting Apple and say, hey, what's going on? Of course, the conspiracy theory in me wonders, have they done this on purpose for some reason? And it prompts me to think, what would that reason be? And you can imagine why they might do that. And I am wondering then, I'm prompted to wonder if I should go ahead and change the name of this show, since I'm no longer dedicating most of the show to reviewing Jim Cramer's Mad Money TV show. And I'm sure that some people who are downloading the show, they listen to it and say, why, this doesn't have anything to do with Mad Money, and they promptly delete it. And so I've been in kind of on the hunt for a new name of the show. And I was thinking things like the Boring Investing Show. I'd want a name where I could get the domain name for it, of course. And those are getting harder and harder to come by as squatters have signed up for all possible combinations of words out there. So I'm looking for a new name. Maybe it should just be the Paul Douglas Boyer Show. That way I can talk about anything I want to talk about. Tell me how you feel about the name change. Of course, the thing I would worry about, too, is if I actually change the name of the show and change the feed of the show, that I'll lose a lot of you. So I'm going to need for you to be vigilant and pay attention to the feed. And if I ask you to make a move, would you move with me? Let me know at 206-734-4763. That's the voicemail line. I'd love to take your calls and love to take your feedback. See if you'll come with me to my new feed if I should do that. Do you like popcorn? I have one of these popcorn makers. I think it's called a Stir Crazy from West Bend. It's a, you know, you pour the oil in it, this thing stirs the kernels around in the bottom and then eventually pops it into a clear plastic dome. We have recently discovered that one of the great flavors that you can put on popcorn is Tabasco sauce. Have you ever heard of this? It actually tastes really good. What better combination of flavors than Tabasco sauce, butter, and salt on popcorn? I encourage you to try it and let me know how you like it. On the blog, madmoneymachine.com, I have a posting there, Bogle, 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 interviewed on podcasts. And there are several podcasts that I listen to. The Index Investing Show, for example, with Ron DeLegge. The Investing Revolution. Speaking of new names, I actually thought about using the name Investing Revolution. And I went out and did a search to see if it was available. And these guys had it, and that's how I found out about their show, The Investing Revolution. You can get that through iTunes as well as The Index Investing Show. Also, Econ Talk. Now, this was the one that he interviewed John Bogle for about an hour on the show, the longest interview of Bogle that I know of. That is also available through iTunes. And then, of course, the Consuelo Mac thing that I've talked about before. You can find links to all those in the show notes for the show and out the posting at the blog site. Are you a do-it-yourselfer? Do you mow your own lawn or do you pay someone to mow your lawn? Do you clean your own house or do you pay someone to come in and clean your house? When you go buy a new dishwasher, do you install it yourself or do you pay someone to deliver it and install it? There are different types of people for each of those types of questions, aren't there? How about your investments? Do you invest for yourself or do you pay someone to help you? Obviously, if you're looking to have someone help you, then the sponsor of this show, Index Funds Advisors, is the one I'd recommend. They're a fee-only advisor. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, what's the best thing that you can do? I think the best thing that you could do is go out to Index Funds Advisors' website at ifa.com and look at their examples of how they invest in their various portfolios. Well, first of all, they've got the risk capacity survey. I talked about that. You could take that and you could find out generally what your own risk capacity is. Then you could look at their model portfolios, portfolios 5 through 100, to see how they invest their money in stocks and in bonds. Of the equity portion, although you can't directly invest in Dimensional Fund Advisors funds, you could try and approximate that using Vanguard and other funds. And here's the best approximation that I have come up with so far. you're going to want to get out a pencil or go out to madmoneymachine.com website and look at these. You know, Index Funds Advisors does recommend a slice and dice portfolio. Large cap value, small cap value, micro cap, REIT, international, and of course they break that down even further, international small value, and emerging markets, which they break down into emerging markets, small and small value also. The closest approximation that I can come to for you is large cap value, small cap value, micro cap, REIT, international value, international small, and emerging markets. Here are the funds then that you could look at that match those categories. For large cap, how could you get any more large cap than the S&P 500, which is the Vanguard 500 Index, VFINX. Large cap value fund, you could go to the Vanguard Value Index Fund, VIVAX, or the Vanguard Value ETF, VTV. And the ETF for the large cap would be VV. Well, how about a small cap value? There you might look at the Vanguard Small Cap Value Index, VISVX. Or if you're into an ETF, maybe the RIDEX S&P Small Cap 600 Value, RZV. Micro cap, look at the Bridgeway Ultra Small Company Fund, BRSIX. Or for an ETF, the iShares Russell Micro Cap, IWC. The REITs, Vanguard REIT Index, VGSIX, or the ETF VNQ. International Value, Vanguard's International Value, VTRIX, or the ETF out there, the iShares MSCI Value Index, EFV. For the International Small, Vanguard International Explorer, VINEX, which is actually closed to new investors, and it's also an actively managed fund. So, what do we think? But instead, you could try a new ETF on the horizon there, the WisdomTree International Small Company, DLS. And finally, emerging markets, the Vanguard Emerging Market Stocks, VEIEX, or perhaps their ETF, the Emerging Markets, VWO. And of course, you can't recall all that. That's why you need to go out to Mad Money Machine and look in the show notes for show 59 to see the do-it-yourself portfolio. Another thing to keep in mind about this is it makes a difference whether you are investing in a taxable or a tax-sheltered retirement account in these funds. These funds are not necessarily good for taxable accounts, especially the REIT or the ones that pay higher dividends. The do-it-yourselfer should know how to allocate your funds across investment vehicles. And keep in mind that I am not giving you financial advice. I'm giving you pointers on where to look and find out the answers for yourself. And even though I understand that you like to do things yourself sometimes, mowing the lawn to get exercise, cleaning the house to get exercise or to save money on maid service, or installing your own dishwasher to save money, investing on your own, the only thing you exercise is your fingers on the keyboard and your brain, because I don't think you necessarily save money by investing yourself here, because the returns that you're going to look at IFA are after all fees. So the thing to do is, if you've been investing yourself for a while, go back and look at your statements for the past few years, pick a starting point, compare that with the returns that investing in one of the index folios has given in the past, and just compare. Do the benchmarking yourself. Have you been able to beat the indexes on your own? If not, why are you doing it? Let's do step four, shall we? Step four is about time pickers. You should understand that no one can pick the right time to be in or out of the market. When 32 market timing newsletters were compared with the S&P 500 index over a 10-year period, not one of them beat the broad market index. primary reason of this inability to time the market is the high concentration of returns and losses that occur in just a period of a few days. In a 10-year period, about 88% of the total gain was concentrated in a period of just 40 days out of 10 years. It's impossible to pick those 40 days in advance. I'd like to continue this step four now with author Mark Hebner, the author of Index Funds, a 12-step program for active investors. Mark, tell us some of the difficulties that time pickers experience.
Well, the difficulties faced by time pickers are among the most difficult and the most dangerous for investors. In essence, it's pretty simple. They have to predict the future. And if you looked at the painting that we had done for this step, you can see the fortune teller with her big crystal ball there. It's kind of silly to even think that you can predict the future. But something that tends to make more sense for people is that they think that there's some trend. It may be similar to they thinking there's some trend when they're playing craps in Las Vegas, because the dice has had a certain streak in one direction or the next. And the confusing thing for investors is they mix up what statisticians call random drift with luck. And in fact, when we look at the record of these market timers, it's very dismal. Turns out that some 25 market timers were tracked over a 10-year period, and not one of them ended up with a return in excess of the S&P 500. Now think about this. 25 newsletters charging investors, I don't even know the fees, but they're crazy, from probably $100 to several thousand dollars a month, giving them the signals to buy or to sell their whole portfolio, go back and forth between stocks and cash, and for all of that timing, all of that reading of newsletters, all the mailing, all the employees involved, the results were absolutely zero. And in fact, it was worse than that. In many cases, many investors ended up with negative returns and paid a large amount of taxes for their efforts to move in and out of the market in short periods.
All right, tell us a little bit about how the random walk theory and the efficient market hypothesis apply here.
Let's first talk about the random walk theory. The random walk theory has a very rich history of documentation going all the way back to March 29, 1900, where a French mathematician, Louis Bachier, first published a paper titled The Theory of Speculation. In that paper, he identified the random movement of stock prices, much like the random movement of molecules in water or in the sky. This randomness is really associated with the news, and the news is what moves stock prices. My favorite way for investors to think about this is a simple little logic phrase that says news moves markets, news is unpredictable, and therefore the movements of markets are unpredictable. This is in essence what we call the random walk theory. You just don't know what's going to happen next. The efficient market theory is a little different. What that says is once this random news hits the 200,000 Bloomberg terminals around the world that control most of the world's wealth, it is very rapidly incorporated into the price of all investments. So just imagine 200,000 very, very wealthy investors, or investors who are in charge of a lot of money, getting the exact same news story at the exact same moment. And when this occurs, there's really no opportunity for one of those investors to consistently exploit all other investors. And that's what's required for them to end up beating the average of the market. They have to, day after day, outsmart the millions of other very, very intelligent investors. You might think of market efficiency like a school of piranhas. And the news stories are kind of like a lamb chop being dropped into this pool of piranhas, the piranhas being the trader. In a matter of seconds, the lamb is chewed up, like the news is chewed up. It's internalized into stock market prices. And then within probably 5 minutes' time, that news is already in the stock market price and things calm down, waiting for the next news story or the next lamb chop in the pool.
In step three, we learned about one of the dangers of stock pickers is that they're subject to paying more taxes and more associated fees. Do time pickers have some of the same issues?
Of course, the time pickers' movements in and out of the market generate short-term capital gains for those pickers if they're doing them within a 12-month period. And more than likely, that will be the case. These newsletters who send out these signals to investors telling them now's the time to buy or now's the time to sell need to do that several times a year. Otherwise, it doesn't look like they're providing some valuable service to the investor. Now that I mentioned that, we may want to review their record. Mark Holbert is somebody who tracks these market timing newsletters. And in one study, he looked at about 25 of these who existed over a 10-year period. And at the end of that period, amazingly, none of the newsletters ended up with a return in excess of just a simple buy and hold S&P 500 index fund. So for all of the money and time spent by the readers and writers of those newsletters, there was essentially no value added for these investors who thought they were getting some important market timing signals.
All right, let's see if I understand the point here. Basically, what you're saying is that in order to capture positive market returns on any portfolio, it's really necessary to stay invested for the long term in order to earn that reward. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Turns out that the market returns are very highly concentrated. And most of the time, the returns are just like watching grass grow, just steady and just slowly plugging along. But every so often, we get a big story about capitalism, in essence, that gives the market a jolt. In my book, I identify a number of those days where the market was up 2 to 5% even. And those are the days that you have to be invested or you're going to miss the returns of the market. In one major study, they looked at a 10-year period and they found out that on average, about 4 days a year, just a very short period of time, 90% of the stock market returns were concentrated in just those 4 days. So if you think about it, how are you supposed to know which days those are and how are you supposed to capture those? Likewise, the losses of the market are also highly concentrated. And so many of these time-picking newsletters or market timing newsletters, as they're called, like to tell investors that they know when these bad days are coming along and when you should jump out of the market. And the fact of the matter is they have no way to know. And occasionally somebody gets lucky and they make a good call in the market. And once they do that, everybody comes rushing to them as if they're some guru with a crystal ball.
I wonder what tomorrow has in mind for me. Or am I even in its mind at all? Perhaps I'll get a chance to look ahead and see. Soon as I find myself a crystal ball. Soon as I find myself a crystal ball. So tell me, won't you tell me? I just gotta know.
Thank you very much, Mark. You know, the closest thing I can think of that we have to a crystal ball is 80 years of past stock market history. The past is prologue. History repeats itself. If you believe in capitalism, then you can believe in the markets. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble. And for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. Here we go! And the winner of this time on Mad Money Machine Show 59 is Michael Malbusen. Michael Malbusen joined Legg Mason Capital Management as Chief Investment Strategist in 2004. Prior to that, he was a packaged food industry analyst. Malbusen's work focuses on the process of value creation from both the company's and the investor's standpoint. His multidisciplinary approach draws ideas from fields including finance, strategy, psychology, and complexity theory. In 2004, Smart Money Magazine named Michael as one of its Power 30 a list of the most influential people on Wall Street. He's the author of More Than You Know, Finding Financial Wisdom in Unconventional Places from 2006. Mike received a BA in Government from Georgetown University. Well, I have read this book, More Than You Know, and at first I was a little bit disappointed in it. I was expecting something along the lines of Nassim Nicholas Taleb's Fooled by Randomness type of discussion, discourse, continuous thread of thought. Well, Michael's Malbusin, and I'm going to pronounce it that way in the absence of knowing really how to pronounce it because I haven't heard anyone say it. Malbusin, the book to me feels like a collection of blog entries. Each chapter is like a blog entry. And in fact, it is a collection of essays. And some of them are good and some of them are just so-so. Point out one of the good ones. Chapter 28 is Chasing Laplace's Demon, the Role of Cause and Effects in Markets. In the chapter, he says, in investing, our innate desire to connect cause and effect collides with the elusiveness of such links. So what do? Naturally, we make up stories to explain cause and effect. Why should investors care about cause and effect in the market? An appreciation of our need for explanation can be an inoculation against making mistakes. Investors who insist on understanding the causes for the market's moves risk focusing on faulty causality or inappropriately anchoring on false explanations. Many of the big moves in the market are not easy to explain. And I was thinking about that and I thought, you know, what's a good metaphor for describing? This is something I've been wanting to say on the show for many months now. I've been wanting to talk about a metaphor for describing the stock market's moves. Up and down, up and down. And you think about that and you think about tides in the ocean, the waves, the water going up and down. But it doesn't work as a great metaphor because in the end, the average of that is zero. It doesn't go anywhere. It goes up and it goes down and it averages out to zero. So the stock market over time goes up, has gone up. We'd like to think it's going to continue to go up. Because productivity and businesses continue to thrive in the global economy. So I was thinking, okay, we're at the beach, there's the ocean, how about the sand? You know how you make a sand pile? You put some fine sand that's dry in your hands and you sprinkle it out onto the beach and it starts forming this pyramid. Occasionally you put a few more grains of sand and the pyramid collapses down. So what if you made a chart of the height of that sand pile? A graph over time of the height of that sand pile. You would see that it would go up and up and then would go down a little bit. And then would go up and up and up and it would go down a little bit more. And it would go up and up and up and down a little bit more. And I think that's exactly the way the stock market moves. And it's an excellent metaphor for the stock market. Well, check this out. I turned the page. Page 188. He says, we can describe many complex systems as being in the state of self-organized criticality. Self-organized means that there is no leader. The system arises from the interaction of many underlying individuals. Criticality suggests non-linearity. More specifically, the magnitude of a perturbation within the system, cause, is not always proportionate to its effect. Small perturbations can lead to large outcomes and vice versa. And then there was this paragraph. A sand pile metaphor conveys this idea. Imagine sprinkling sand onto a flat surface. At first, not much happens, and the sand grains obey the basic laws of physics. But once the sand pile builds to a certain height and slope, it enters into a self-organized critical state. A few additional grains sprinkled on the pile may lead to a small or large avalanche. The size of the avalanche need not match the amount of sand the researcher sprinkles. To make this metaphor more relevant to investors, replace sand grains with information. Sometimes a piece of information barely moves the market. At other times, seemingly similar information causes a big move. Models of information cascades provide some insight into why this happens, and he's got a reference for these models in the book. Well, I could not believe the coincidence of that, and I guess it's just great minds think alike. Another chapter I like in the book is chapter 29, More Power to You, Power Laws, and what they mean for investors. Now, I had seen some discussion out at the Die Hards www.thebestinvestmentforum.org forum. People really get into the nitty-gritty out there. If you're interested in that sort of thing, go out there. And then we're talking about using standard deviation as a measure of risk. And one of the more academically inclined posters mentioned that, yeah, standard deviation measures some of it, but to get it all, what you really need is a power law. So Michael Malbusen talks about this in his book, and he talks about some other examples of power laws outside of the stock market. For example, George Zipf, a Harvard linguist, noticed the relationship in a number of systems back in the 30s and summarized them in his book, Human Behavior and the Principle of the Least Effort. Zipf's law, Z-I-P-F's law, as scientists came to call it, is actually only one of an example of many power laws. This power law implies that you see a very few words very frequently and many words relatively rarely. And then he goes on to talk about the rank and size of U.S. cities. And there are very few large cities and a whole bunch of small cities. And if you plot this on a graph, in specifically a log-log graph, meaning both the axis of y-axis and the x-axis are logarithmic, meaning every increment is a power of 10. So you have 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1 million, 10 million, and so on. If you use the y-axis as size and the x-axis going across the bottom as the number of them, at the top left you'd have very few big things. A straight line extends to the bottom right then, where you have a whole lot of very little things. And that goes for cities. It goes for the usage of words in language. And the same thing goes for animal species. You have very few large animals and an enormous number of very tiny animals. And what the Diehards Forum pointed me out to was a letter that appeared in the journal Nature in 2003 called A Theory of Power Law Distributions in Financial Market Fluctuations. And I'll read the abstract. Insights into the dynamics of a complex system are often gained by focusing on large fluctuations. For the financial system, huge databases now exist that facilitate the analysis of large fluctuations and the characterization of their statistical behavior. Power laws appear to describe histograms of relevant financial fluctuations, such as fluctuations in stock price, trading volume, and the number of trades. Surprisingly, the exponents that characterize these power laws are similar for different types and sizes of markets, for different market trends, and even for different countries, suggesting that a generic theoretical basis may underlie these phenomena. And it goes on to say they propose a model, blah, blah, blah. The model is based on the hypothesis that large movements in stock market activity arise from the trades of large participants, starting from an empirical characterization of the size distribution of those large market participants, mutual funds. We show that the power laws observed in the financial data arise when the trading behavior is performed in an optimal way. Our model additionally explains certain striking empirical regularities that describe the relationship between large fluctuation in prices, trading volume, and the number of trades. And the article is full of graphs and weird mathematical symbols just to confuse the lay reader. I mean, it's nothing that you can't say in a simple sentence. Near the end, it says, "It is an important feature of the model that large trades beget more trades." It takes me back to the sand pile thing. If you have a large collapse in the sand pile, it just keeps collapsing more and more, doesn't it? And I think the bottom line of all the power law talk is basically, yes, standard deviation captures a great deal of the risk that has been in the market. But you can indeed get the rare event, the big event, either a big up move or more likely a big down move in the stock market. Well, if you're a hardcore investment junkie, might want to pick up a copy of Michael Malbusen's book entitled More Than You Know. Well, there's our guru for show 59. Michael Malbusen. I always look forward to getting your calls at the Madman Machine voicemail line 206-734-4763. Let's have a quick look at the Portfolio Smackdown as of Monday, April 16th, where we're taking about 23 people who have portfolios of $100,000 to start with, managed under the influence of James J. Kramer, and their average year-to-date, 2007, is up 3.29%, but the Index Folio 100 Bright Red from IFA.com is up 7.78%, beating it by 4.5%, more than double the gains of the average portfolios of these 23 investors influenced by James J. Kramer, except for Alan Pendleton, trader extraordinaire. Now, here's what I recommend. Everybody give your $100,000 to Alan Pendleton. Let him manage your money, because he is up 14.88% on the year. How do you do it, Alan? We need to know the secrets of your genius and your trading wisdom. No, seriously, Alan, send me the winners that came out of your portfolio. How did you do it? I've been looking through the history of your stock picks there, and I can't figure out exactly which ones helped you make $14,888 so far this year. This has been Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes grinding up your crystal ball into a large sand pile to make a mad money machine. I will see you next week. Remember to visit our sponsor at ifa.com. All music provided by music.podshow.com. Stay invested.